Lakers. How you doing? God, I missed you so much. 4-day weekends are just ugly. God, I hate them. I hate them. Don't you? Welcome to the Molloy Program. It is Monday. It's also about 7 minutes past the hour. We have absolutely a chock-a-block program for you this evening, including, possibly, if we have the time, I hope so, Uncle Mike's Story Corner, the Thanksgiving edition, sort of. I want to give you some information here about Barbara Bush, former First Lady Babs, Barbara Bush, the mother of four of the most criminal white men, Christian, whatever you want to call them, ever to pollute the political landscape. You know, Barbara Bush. It's from CNN. Remember, she had some surgery, laparoscopic surgery. When was it? Last Tuesday? Yeah, she went to Methodist Hospital in Houston. She was complaining of severe abdominal pain, and doctors determined that she had a perforated ulcer in her duodenum, or her duodenum. How do you say that? Duodenum? Duodenum? Either way. That's the first portion of the small intestine right after the stomach. So it's now been reported that former First Lady Barbara Bush is on a liquid diet that began today as part of her laparoscopic surgery. And the part that I found extremely interesting is that, according to the release from Methodist Hospital in Houston, doctors thoroughly cleaned Mrs. Bush's abdominal cavity of any contaminants that had leaked through the hole in her duodenum, described by the hospital as being 1 centimeter in diameter. Then doctors repaired the ulcer and sewed a piece of the omentum, that's fat tissue in the abdomen, on top of it to seal it. Okay? Just a little medical update there on the former First Lady. She is in good condition and expected to recover as expected, according to the statement. The only problem with the liquid diet, it started this morning and already the hospital blood bank is dangerously low. So they're asking for donations from anyone who's type O, type A, type B, type AB, any type blood in the Houston area. The former First Lady needs your help. And if that's not enough, you remember the pastor out there at Saddleback Church, Rick Warren, what's his book? The Purpose Driven Life, right? The Purpose Driven Life. Pastor Rick Warren. He says this is to mark World AIDS Day. And Pastor Rick Warren has decided to host what he calls a civil forum on global health in Washington, D.C., at which point or place Rick Warren will present President Bush with the first International Medal of Peace from the Global Peace Coalition, whatever that is, in recognition of Mr. Bush's unprecedented contribution to the fight against HIV/AIDS and other diseases. The release says that the International Medal of Peace is given for outstanding contribution toward alleviating the five global giants recognized by the coalition, including pandemic diseases, extreme poverty, illiteracy, self-centered leadership, and spiritual emptiness. George Bush, the first ever International Medal for Peace. This was posted at thinkprogress.org, and there were comments after the posting. Here's a couple of comments. Tom writes, Rick Warren is giving GW a Medal of Peace. hell has frozen over? Bob Wurst writes and says, yeah, let's just make up an award and give it a PC-ness name, and nobody will remember that Bush attacked a nation without provocation. While we're at it, I'm going to give Jeffrey Dahmer the first annual Vegetarian of the Year award for his work in turning people away from eating meat. Unbelievable says Bush deserves a trial in a jail cell, not an award. And adds, conservatives really do create their own reality, don't they? And a Patriot Acting says, what does it mean when a recipient of this medal is the direct cause of extreme poverty, illiteracy, self-centered leadership, and spiritual emptiness? I guess in Pastor Rick Warren's warped sense of reality, 1 out of 5 ain't too bad. Well, I found the whole thing to be spooky. Again, that strange, disconnected feeling that I've gotten repeatedly over the past 8 years, but especially here lately, that somehow everything is just like a millisecond off for me. I'm just a tiny bit outside the time-space continuum that seems to be operating where these releases come from, or these awards come from, or the news comes from. You ever get that feeling? Huh? Like it's just, wait a second, what? No, that, And for the most part, most of us, when we get that sense, right, we just ignore it. I mean, you can't focus on that all the time. If you do, you'll go mad, maybe. So we don't focus on it. Oh, I've got food poisoning. Oh, must be a head cold. Oh, well, I'm distracted. Well, I've been feeling anxiety lately. Well, I'm worried about the kids. Well, I don't know. I'm worried about my job. We have these very valid reasons for trying to identify that disconnected feeling. But maybe it's none of that. Maybe it really is something that the axis of the earth is tilting just a little bit, or something is shifting under your feet, or under my feet, or when Pastor Rick Warren, who ostensibly represents the gospel of the Lord and Savior of the world, Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace, love, do unto others as you do to the least of these among you, you do it to me, suffer the little children. You know, that Jesus, I think Pastor Warren speaks on behalf of that Jesus. How in the hell, you'll pardon the use of the word there, how in the hell can Pastor Rick Warren award the first ever International Medal of Peace to a war criminal like George Bush, who, among other things we know, authorized torture, whose global policies contribute to, if not cause, poverty and illiteracy, who defines self-centered leadership? I'm the decider. Bring him on. Who personifies spiritual emptiness? What is Rick Warren trying to do? Become the next Billy Graham or something? Rick Warren, shame on you.
He can't. He's the primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
It's 21 and a half past the hour. All right, our from our series of periodic reports from our economic correspondent, that would be Prairie 2, he writes, "Say, Mike, the stock market dropped like leftover turkey today, losing 680 points, heavily drawn down by retail stocks, even though there were claims that retail sales were up and foot traffic was up, but bag counts were down, meaning people who were shopping over the weekend were bargain hunting and not committed buyers. Further pressure on retail stocks is that there are only five companies left to dominate consumer mortgage and credit cards, and reports are they're planning to trim $2 trillion from consumer lines of credit, making economic recovery impossible. You would think companies that make their money by lending to consumers would want to keep doing that. They have gotten trillions in tax money in the past year to keep the economy from tanking because they lost their ass in the derivative markets and are now going to tank the economy anyway and keep our money. Public hangings? Anyone? The dollar, Prairie 2 writes, has been exceptionally strong against other currencies in the past few months. But according to UN economists, this will end in the coming year and the dollar will head for the floor, crash through, and keep on going down. The reason? Unsustainable amounts of U.S. debt. At some point, countries that still accept dollars will stop accepting them. We have a $700 billion trade deficit, and we can't print our own euros. We're going to need to get by with $700 billion less of stuff, assuming that we can continue to trade for the rest of it, at as favorable terms as we get now. The $62 trillion in denominated debt draws $12 trillion in interest, even at government bond rates. That's only a couple of trillion less than our current GDP, and the GDP is going down almost as fast as the debt is going up. Some people aren't going to be happy about getting stiffed. It's not impossible that Obama can fix this. Basically, the U.S. will have to go through some sort of Chapter 11, canceling debt and recovering assets from people who stole them through market manipulation. It may not even be apparent to the public if it works. If it doesn't work, or worse, if this is not Obama's intent, then the consequences will be dire. I'm not kidding about the canned goods. Prairie 2. Well, yeah, you know, over the weekend I started thinking, well, you know, the economic crisis is over. Look, the stock market has gone way up again. Everything's okay. I can't be bad. We're in recovery mode here. Yeah, that's called what is one step worse than wishful thinking? Magical thinking. Yeah. Wishful thinking, you just kind of like, oh, gosh, I wish I had a new puppy. Magical thinking is, look, there's a whole bunch of puppies in my living room. Cheryl in Burbank, California writes, hey, Mike, I don't know what paper you read in the morning, but I get the L.A. Times. They had a front page story this morning about Obama's healthcare initiatives and what we're likely to see as his proposals. They're reporting that a single-payer healthcare system is, quote, off the table, end quote, and won't even be discussed as one of the policy choices under consideration. What is the matter with us? Cheryl asks. Sometimes I think we deserve what we get. Now, Cheryl, remember we declared a moratorium on directly criticizing Barack Obama, right? And regardless of what my little mini blog said today at NovaMradio.com or MikeMalloy.com, we are trying to maintain the moratorium on saying harsh, cruel, and critical things as the president-elect goes through his selection process of running the country. Although it is getting weird, isn't it? Watching these choices, we'll have something on General Jones and Robert Gates a little bit later in the program. It's not very pleasant. Jim in Plymouth, Indiana writes, since President-elect Obama has appointed many people from the Bill Clinton administration in key decision-making positions, and Obama's economic advisors promised more of the same old corporatist anti-labor policies, January will be hailed as the inauguration of Bill Clinton's third term. Oh, maybe Bill Clinton will let Obama give the inaugural address in a press conference now and then, but that's it. One more person is needed for Obama to complete Bill Clinton's dream of a third term. Hire Monica back as his White House intern and pass out the cigars. Just some dumb sarcasm, Jim writes, expressing my frustration at what change you can believe in really looks like. Jim in Plymouth, Indiana.
But they have no right to wield that sword, cause they take their orders from the chairman of the board. IMF, WTO, I hear these words just every place I go. Who are these people? Who elected them? And how do I replace them with some of my friends? Can't you hear? Are you listening?
It's okay, Republicans. The pain will be over soon. Take a deep breath. Find your happy place. It's more of Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. I can't get over the Rick Warren Medal of Global Peace, or whatever the hell it's being called, that is that this crazy pastor is presenting to George W. Bush, apparently the first and possibly the only time this award will ever be given to anyone. But the degree of hypocrisy involved here in handing out the so-called International Medal of Peace, I mean, my God, come on, please, just once, is there any way that any a preacher, Christian preacher, a fundamentalist, evangelical, whatever they are, who can ever just come out and say the truth. I guess there is some area of psychology, I'm well aware of this, where, you know, you accentuate the positive, you reinforce good behavior. Yeah, that's what you do with 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 year old children. But Bush is not a peacemaker. He's a warmonger. He destroys hundreds of thousands of people. I just wish it would almost, not quite, well, actually, far from, but it might restore a bit of my faith in these self-appointed spiritual leaders, that maybe they had something really to say, that maybe the philosophy to which they claim adherence had some sort of validity. Just once! If just once I could have heard Billy Graham say that Lyndon Johnson and Dick Nixon were goddamn murderers and warmongers for what they did in Southeast Asia, for example. And now this Rick Warren, this blue jeans wearing freak who has decided to give an award, international, global, thank you, Jesus, Peace Award, a Medal of Peace, in recognition of a number of things, not the least of which is George W. Bush's exemplary example in fighting HIV/AIDS. George Bush did nothing of the sort. Reg writes in, this award is undoubtedly part of the carefully staged strategy of revisionism that will allow George W. Bush to leave office in a protective bubble of his own making. Killing Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan is not a crime in the churches of pastors for hire like Rick Warren. Neither is withholding accurate information from potential victims of AIDS in Africa. Even today, the corporate media are cooperating in this devious plan by giving Bush totally unmerited credit for his so-called contribution in the fight against AIDS in Africa. As the Warren Award suggests, a reality check is desperately needed because Americans have such a short memory about such matters. If they ever knew anything about the AIDS program at all, here's a snip from an article in The Nation magazine a few years back when the Bush AIDS program was initiated. Quote, the censorious new anti-condom guidelines were issued on 16 June 2004 by Bush's Centers for Disease Control. The new CDC regulations, published in the Federal Register, are mandatory for any AIDS-fighting organization that receives federal money for HIV prevention. And they finish the job. The regulations finish the job of gutting effective disease-preventing safe sex education that has been a goal of the Bush administration since it took office. The regulations demand that any sex ed content include information on the, quote, lack of effectiveness of condom use, end quote. In other words, the Bush administration wants AIDS-fighting organizations to tell people, well, condoms don't work. At the same time, the regulations mandate the teaching of the failed policy of abstinence from sex until heterosexual marriage. When asked about the CDC regulations, Representative Barney Frank told The Nation that, quote, one has to reach back to Stalin and Lyshenko to find an ideological distortion of science this complete, end quote. And Representative Henry Waxman called the CDC guidelines, quote, shameful, end quote. And only the latest anti-condom move by an administration whose policies have been, quote, overwhelmingly suppressing and distorting science, end quote, for political purposes. End of quote from The Nation. Reg writes, the world has tipped a full degree on its axis for sure. Yeah, I remember that. Thanks, Reg. I remember, not to the degree that Reg has pointed out, but I remember this. We're going to fight AIDS. Yes, we are. America's committed to fighting AIDS. Oh, but you can't promote condom use because, you know, you talk about condoms, next thing you know, people might want to screw. And if they do that, well, you know. And besides, we can only talk about condom use. The only time we can is, well, never. What we can talk about is abstinence until you get married to a person of the opposite sex, of course. The transmission route for AIDS on the continent of Africa is, if I remember correctly, for the most part, massively the most part, is heterosexual sexual contact. So now Bush is getting an International Medal of Peace award for doing everything in his power to interfere in the science of preventing the transmission of AIDS. In the meantime, I was listening to The World today on NPR. And 2, 3, 4 million people in various countries in Africa are now receiving generic anti-AIDS drugs. Drugs that a couple of years ago cost $19,000 a year now cost less than a dollar a day. Why? Because a company in India has been producing the generics and shipping them to Africa. Is the company in India owned by a U.S. pharmaceutical company? I have no idea. All I heard was that part of the story. Don't tell them about condoms. It is. It is like living in bizarro world where everything is just a half a beat off. Don't you ever get that feeling? In the New York Times yesterday, huge front page article about the massive corporation known as retired General Barry McCaffrey. You've seen this guy, who's the one that talks sort of funny like this. He's been a consultant to NBC and MSNBC since before this war started. Since before either one of them started. I remember McCaffrey when he used to get the charts out there and oh my goodness, this is going to happen and that's going to happen. This is back when every single network, but especially NBC and MSNBC, were beating the war drums. Well, Fox too, but you know, Fox is... MSNBC and NBC beating the drums for war. Remember that? Oh, my God. They tried, all five or six of the over-the-air and cable networks tried desperately to brand the war just like they did in the first Gulf War. It's ours! We've got the right music. We've got the right graphics. No, over here. No, this, look at us. God damn it, we'll have the best coverage of this war against terror. Yes! Well, if you read the article in the Times, if you didn't, go online. I don't think you have to be a subscriber. Just go online, find it. The article, it's rather lengthy, but it talks about how Barry McCaffrey, the deception. He has been a paid whore. No offense to real sex workers. A whore, a whore. For the corporations that are making a fortune. And MSNBC and NBC never identified him as a whore or a spokesperson. They identified him as a military affairs expert. Never, never, never telling the truth about him. And it's not just McCaffrey. Now, David Barstow, who wrote this for the Times, it's an update of the article he had in April, way back in April, about how the Pentagon, during the run-up to the war with Iraq, and for years after, worked closely with retired military officers who became these television talking heads. And what did they do for us, these military experts? More on this when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
I am a patriot. Yes, I am. Country that's safe, in a land that's clean and free, for every color and culture, every person, every belief. Your greed, your fear, and your lies ain't gonna push me around. I'm gonna use the power I have. I'm gonna vote you right out of that house.
Reality Radio for a Rational World. The Mike Malloy Show, only on Nova M Radio.
It's about 10 before the hour. So Barry McCaffrey, retired four-star general, United States Army. Of course, as the New York Times' David Barstow has pointed out twice now, it's much worse than that. The Pentagon, during the run-up to the occupation with Iraq, the invasion of Afghanistan, all the hell that we have been in subsequent to these two invasions. The Pentagon worked closely with retired military officers who became these TV talking heads. And so many of them have disappeared, but not McCaffrey. Now, the Pentagon worked with these military officers to talk up the war by, among other things, treating the analysts to special briefings and taking them on guided tours of Iraq. But these trips weren't simply fact-finding initiatives. According to the Times, when at least one of the analysts began to criticize the war, he was promptly suspended from the Pentagon program. And according to Media Matters Research, the Pentagon pundits were quoted more than 4,500 times on broadcast networks, cable TV, and NPR. And as Media Matters reports here, among the participants in the Pentagon program were NBC and MSNBC, which threw open their studio doors to the Pentagon pundits without ever disclosing these closed-door prep sessions with the pro-war administration. And in the wake of the New York Times expose, none of the TV news outlets implicated in the story reported on the revelation, despite the fact that the original article back in April prompted a congressional hearing. Now, in the latest installment, Times writer David Barstow focuses on General Barry McCaffrey, who still featured on NBC News despite his substantial, albeit undisclosed, financial conflicts of interest. Here's what Glenn Greenwald had to say, writing at Salon. Quote, "Worse than mere suppression, NBC and Brian Williams have just outright ignored the scandal, continuing to use McCaffrey as an analyst without requiring that he sever or even disclose his numerous conflicts, which allows him to continue to use NBC News to propagandize for the military policies from which his affiliated companies benefit." Greenwald goes on to say, now that New York Times writer David Barstow has added substantially to the set of incriminating facts, it remains to be seen whether NBC will finally be forced to tell its viewers about what happened with its own involvement in the Pentagon's program or take corrective action. And Glenn Greenwald closes with the question, when David Barstow wins the Pulitzer Prize next April for his series on the TV Generals, will television news still boycott the story? You ever feel like you've been rolled? I mean, to the point where thousands of American citizens, soldiers, have died. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of civilians in three countries have died. And the warmongers just continue to make fortunes, blood money, war profiteering. How do people like Barry McCaffrey, how do they do it? How does this guy shave in the morning? You know, when a man shaves in the morning, he's got to stare at himself for at least 5 or 6 minutes, if you're using a razor like I do. If you're using an electric shaver, I don't know. Does it take longer? I have no idea. I hate those damn things. But I still use the lather out of a can. I don't mean I, you know, sit there with a straight razor and a strap and go, and then put soap on my face. But men have to stare at themselves every morning. How does somebody like Barry McCaffrey do that? How do these generals, these retired generals, who know damn good and well the truth of the invasions and wars in both of these countries, how do they do it? I'm not saying what is their reward. We know what their reward is. Tons of money. But how do they do it? Is there any segment of public service left that hasn't been totally compromised, destroyed by the amoral activities of the Bush crime family? Is there any segment, any section that hasn't either been forcibly compromised or been willing partners in compromising science, truth, honor, integrity, morality, ethical conduct? Is there one? Hey, one of you right-wing bastards that listen to this program and never call, send me an email. Will you tell me one public policy institution in the United States that hasn't been turned into owl droppings by this filthy Bush administration? Please tell me one. I'll take anything. Anything. Huh? You got about 6 minutes to think about it. Send me an email. Mike@MikeMalloy.com. All right? Bet you can't. Welcome back. It's 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy program on Nova M Radio. No, it's not Air America. Regarding McCaffrey, Barry McCaffrey, the scum-sucking former four-star general, that means he was a real general, in the United States Army, who has now become nothing more than a shill for various technological and defense industries, and who is used by NBC and MSNBC, which makes sense since both are owned by General Electric, one of the largest weapons manufacturers and therefore purveyors of death on the planet. Regarding McCaffrey, Peter in Vermont writes, McCaffrey has participated in 3 losing wars, Vietnam, the war on drugs, and the current war. And he always said, "We're winning. The final victory is just around the corner. Keep fighting." I guess it really was in his best interest. He made a fortune. Peter in Vermont. Yeah. McCaffrey was the drug czar during what? What was it? Bush 1? Was it Bush? I don't know. He spent 4 years as he did a great job. Huh? How's that coming? Hey, Barry, how's that coming? No money in that one, huh? Jesus God. And regarding feeling just slightly out of sync, as I said I do, and I've gotten emails from people who agree, Jude writes in, you feel as if time has changed. Remember where Vice President Cheney lives? The U.S. Naval Observatory. It's the oldest scientific agency. It has the department or the depot of charts and instruments, the preeminent authority in areas of precise time, astrometry, and distributes Earth's orientation. What do you think? No. Couldn't be. Could it? I wanted to get this last week and did not. It comes to the Miami Herald. Barack Obama was considering for his top intelligence post a former senior U.S. intelligence official who was involved with the Bush administration's so-called enhanced interrogation, torture, and also involved in the secret transfers of suspects to nations that torture people, nations that torture anyone they feel like torturing, including political opponents. Like, oh, I don't know, think of a country real quick. Oh, there's one, Egypt. The guy's name is John Brennan, a former senior CIA official and head of Barack Obama's intelligence transition team. And he bailed out. In a letter to Barack Obama, a copy of which was obtained by McClatchy newspapers, Brennan denied involvement in the Bush administration's detaining interrogation policies and said he was taking himself out of the running, you know, to avoid entangling the new administration in unnecessary controversy. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Brennan was reported to have been under consideration as the successor to CIA Director Michael Hayden, another vocal advocate of bad things. Obama has been under pressure from normal Americans, you know, just people, to replace Michael Hayden, because he oversaw and defended the Bush crime family's program of eavesdropping on anybody in America that they felt like eavesdropping on without court warrants when he was head of the National Security Agency. So rather than fire the son of a bitch for violating the Constitution to which he swore an oath, I would think, I don't know, maybe the head of the National Security Agency doesn't have to swear an oath. But if he did, then what is it? Is that constitutional perjury? What is it? I don't know. It doesn't mean anything. This is what I was saying last hour. Every single aspect of public service has been corrupted, destroyed by this filthy Bush crime family. So when he broke the law, violated the Constitution, participated in the cover-up, what happened to him? Well, of course, he's promoted to the head of the CIA. Now, ironically, Barack Obama voted in the Senate against Michael Hayden's nomination to the CIA post in 2006. That was Senator Obama's protest against the eavesdropping program. I guess that's not ironic at all, is it? You know. But anyway, this guy, John Brennan, his appointment as head of Barack Obama's intelligence transition team, according to the Miami Herald, ignited a storm of protests by liberal commentators, bloggers, and others who linked Brennan to the Bush administration's detainee and interrogation policies. Now, this is a part that I find very interesting. If so-called liberal commentators and bloggers can get this information, the correct Obama transition team, and I'm not criticizing, I've declared a moratorium. I am not criticizing our president-elect. He deserves a chance. I'm just curious. If liberal commentators and bloggers can get the information, why couldn't, I don't know, pick a name. Rahm Emanuel! Why couldn't he have gotten the same information and prevented this little, flare-up? This little incident that would cause, I think, among most of us, a loss of confidence, or at least a questioning of who's making the decisions where it concerns national security? What? Huh? U.S. allies and many legal authorities have decried the secret transfers of detained terrorism suspects, known as extraordinary rendition, to nations that practice torture and such interrogation practices like waterboarding in secret CIA prisons as being illegal under international law and U.S. law. And the irony, there is irony here. John Brennan was serving in top CIA posts while those practices were underway. And Barack Obama said he opposes that. So John Brennan, who was going to be possibly the successor to Michael Hayden, John Brennan, who was the head of Barack Obama's intelligence transition team. John Brennan, last Tuesday, said, listen, I really haven't done anything wrong. I haven't been involved in terror or torture or renditions, extraordinary renditions, or, killing people while I stood there and laughed did bad things to him. I haven't done anything like that, but I think I'm going to bow out of an incipient Obama regime because I don't want to cause any controversy. So I'm going to take the self-sacrificial step of removing myself from being considered as head of the CIA. Damn. That would have been so much fun. But we do have Hillary Clinton. Now, Gates. Everybody real comfortable with Secretary Robert Gates, who will be staying in that top Pentagon job for at least the first year? Everybody happy with that? You know, he's a former Eagle Scout. He's part of this national security team now, Hillary Clinton. General Jim Jones, retired, former Marine general. Dennis Blair, retired admiral, director of national intelligence. Susan Rice, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Everybody happy with all this? Well, just a little bit on Gates that you may or may not know when we come back. Okay? Stick around.
Faster than a flying monkey, more powerful than a special prosecutor, it's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
It's 21 past the hour. Got to share this with you. Robert Perry, writing at consortiumnews.com, also last Tuesday, another one that we missed. Robert Perry, who pretty much broke the Iran-Contra story in the United States and then followed up on it for various news organizations until he was relieved of his command, because Robert Perry had the disconcerting habit of telling too much truth. Who can't have that? Anyway, he writes that nearly 16 years ago, during the last transition from a Bush to a Democrat, the powers that be in Russia, in Moscow, made an extraordinary gesture to the powers that be in Washington. The Kremlin supplied a summary of its intelligence information about a secret U.S.-Iranian contacts, about all secret U.S.-Iranian contacts in the 1980s. The report was from a National Security Committee of the Russian Duma to representative at the time Lee Hamilton, who had requested what might be in Moscow's files as part of a task force investigation into whether the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980 had interfered with Jimmy Carter's bid to free the American hostages that were then held in Iran. You remember the story if you're old enough. I realize a lot of people who were probably just being born in 1980. Well, that makes sense, Mike. But the Iran-Contra affair is one of those horrific stories that just keep on giving. We'll never really know the truth. The corporate powers that run the United States have made sure that the truth will never come out. But every once in a while you get these little leaks from people like Robert Perry. The Russian report arrived late via the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. It was requested in the 80s. It showed up on January 11, 1993, but the contents were stunning. The Russians reported that their intelligence revealed that long-rumored meetings between Republicans and Iranians in Europe during campaign 1980 had indeed occurred. Now, this information went against what Lee Hamilton and other members of the task force on Iran-Contra. Isn't it amazing how Lee Hamilton always shows up on these investigative committees? What they had decided to conclude, the report from the Russians was contrary to what our boys reported. Our boys reported there had been no such contacts. Hamilton had already turned down advice from his chief counsel that the investigation be extended a few months because, you know, there might be other late-arriving evidence of Republican guilt. But no. Instead, Hamilton ordered the probe wrapped up with the conclusion that the Republicans were innocent. There was never any contact between the Iranians and the Republicans regarding tow missiles and holding the hostages a little bit longer. Ronald Reagan, we'll give you a better deal. We'll buy more tow missiles that we can then use in Central America. We'll make you some money, boys. Just don't release those hostages. Because then Ronald Reagan will have no reason to be elected, and the whole Reagan episode would not have possibly occurred. But you see, the Russian report represented another complication for Lee Hamilton, especially since the task force's debunking report had already gone to the printers and was set to be released 2 days later on January 13th, 1993. What was going on January 13th, 1993? Oh, you're so quick tonight. Absolutely. It was right before the swearing in of Bill Clinton. So the Russian report, like much of the other incriminating evidence, was kept secret, stuck in a cardboard box and filed away in a makeshift Capitol Hill storage room, gone. Poof. The report, however, ended up not just in a makeshift Capitol Hill storage room, but in an abandoned ladies' room off the Rayburn House office building's parking garage. Ooh, where Robert Perry discovered it in late 1994. One of the Americans implicated by the Russian report was,
oh my, what's this?
Robert Gates, who in 1980 was a junior CIA official who had served on Carter's National Security Council staff before returning to the CIA as executive assistant to CIA Director Stansfield Turner. As translated by the U.S. Embassy, the Russian report stated, quote, Robert Gates, at that time a staffer of the National Security Council in the administration of Jimmy Carter and former CIA Director George Herbert Walker Bush, also took part in a meeting with Iranians in Paris in October 1980. What? But he didn't he used to work for Jimmy Carter? But how could this be? Chapter 2 when we come back.
The ozone layer has no ozone anymore, and you're gonna leave me for the guy next door. I'm sick of you. I'm sick of you. They arrested the mayor for an illegal favor, sold the Empire State to Japan. And Oliver North married William C. Corden, gave birth to a little Tehran. And the Ayatollah bought a nuclear warship. If he dies, he wants to go out in style. And there's nothing to eat that don't carry the stink of some dumped in the Nile. But one thing is certainly true, no one here knows what to do, and I'm sick of you. I'm sick of you.
Do not go gently into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
Oh yes, 25 before the hour, we are talking about Robert Gates, who has a very interesting history. Working for Jimmy Carter and then for the Republicans and then for CIA Director Stansfield Turner. Robert Perry, writing last week at consortiumnews.com, talks about or has written about the information provided by Russian intelligence that Robert Gates, while he was a staffer at the National Security Council in the administration of Jimmy Carter and former CIA director George Herbert W. or George Herbert Walker Bush, what Perry is saying here, that Gates and Bush Sr. took part in a meeting with Iranians in Paris in October 1980. That was the famous October surprise, right? Now, writing at Consortium News, Perry goes on to say, when the Russian report arrived in Washington about all this in early 1993, Robert Gates was then George Herbert Walker Bush's last CIA director. This is right at the time when Bush was, Pappy Bush was leaving. And then Gates went on to be president of Texas A&M, served there for a number of years. Then he reemerged onto the national stage when Bush II named him defense secretary in late 2006. That was to replace the murderous, dishonored, dishonorable, what's his name? And now, as we all know, President-elect Barack Obama has decided to keep Gates on as a gesture of bipartisanship and continuity. Uh-oh. Now, as Robert Perry writes, what Barack Obama should have done, keep in mind that Perry was writing this last week, he might want to finish the investigation that Lee Hamilton swept under the rug 16 years ago. And again, isn't it amazing how Lee Hamilton is always the go-to guy when something needs to be covered up? Huh? Isn't it? Barack Obama should ask, he still has time, at least ask the Kremlin what exactly its evidence is about Gates' role in the Republican-Iranian contacts in 1980, the October surprise case. Now, Gates has denied any role. No. Wait. Not me. And it's possible, of course, that the Russian intelligence is garbage. Right? But with the Russian administration now signaling that it hopes for improved relations with the Obama administration, Russian authorities might be willing to share whatever evidence they have. We can check it out very quickly, can't we? Is there anyone left in the CIA or the NSA or the DCI or any of these organizations that we can trust to tell the truth? Is there any? Anybody? Hello? Robert Perry says, over the years, I've tried to get a fuller explanation of the Russian report, never had much success. What is clear, though, is that after Ronald Reagan took office and sent his campaign chief, William Casey, who was the director of the CIA, before he developed a brain tumor on Wednesday and died on Thursday, remember that? During that time, Robert Gates' career took off. William Casey, who was also implicated in the October surprise controversy, elevated Gates to be the assistant director for intelligence analysis. And then Gates was raised to deputy CIA director. And later, of course, Gates was linked to both the Iran-Contra scandal, which involved the trading of arms for hostages with Iran, and the Iraqgate controversy, the clandestine military support given to Iraq's Saddam Hussein during his 8-year war with Iran. See, Mr. Gates has been all over the place. Right? The Iran-Contra connection, Robert Perry writes, cost Gates his first shot to become CIA director in 1987, but President George Herbert Walker Bush gave him another chance in 1991. Gates was helped by friends on the Democratic side of the aisle, most notably Senator David Boren, Senate Intelligence Committee chairman, and Boren's chief of staff at the time, well, here's a surprise, George Tenet. And during campaign 2008, just passed, Gates got lucky again when former Senator Boren and former representative and cover-up specialist Lee Hamilton both emerged as senior foreign policy advisors to Obama. Reportedly, they are the two, Boren and Hamilton, who urged Obama to retain their old friend as head of the Pentagon. Oh, my goodness. But this is not criticism of the choices being made by Barack Obama. I have declared a moratorium. I say give the man a chance. I say he's only the president-elect, and as he has said on a couple of occasions now, there can only be one president of the United States at any given time, with which I completely and fully agree. Don't you? Can we return just for a moment to General Barry McCaffrey? He had been a major general and a brigadier and a lieutenant general, but when he retired, he was a real general. That's 4 stars. Irish Dave sent me in a little bit of truth here from truthdig.com, written by Stan Goff, who you may remember his name, 26-year veteran of the U.S. Army Special Forces. Stan Goff, one of the few people left, I guess, that we can believe when he says something. But Goff wrote a lengthy article, posted at TruthDig back on October 3rd, 2006, 2 years ago. Let me just give you one sentence. And the formative moment in Iraq for Timothy McVeigh was the order by Major General Barry McCaffrey, the sociopath appointed by Bill Clinton to be the nation's drug czar, to slaughter a 7-mile line of retreating Iraqi soldiers and civilians after the ceasefire in Iraq, now called the Turkey Shoot. Major General Barry McCaffrey. That's right, he was Bill Clinton's drug czar. Major General, at the time, Major General Barry McCaffrey. At the time, Timothy McVeigh served in the United States Army before he blew up the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. He was a soldier under the command of Major General Barry McCaffrey and ordered that, do you remember that, the Highway of Death or the Turkey Shoot? I guess if you were in the military, it was called the Turkey Shoot. If you were in media, it was called the Highway of Death. Much more snap to it when you call it the Highway of Death. Turkey Shoot sounds, Turkey Shoot, big deal. Highway of Death has a certain resonance, has a certain cachet, has a certain, attractiveness. Remember those pictures? Come on, you can do it! Remember the pictures from Gulf War I? Whoever took the video swooped down. Maybe it was military video, but it made it to television. Do you remember those pictures? Just an endless line of charred vehicles and charred bodies. Iraqis who were fleeing, who had given up. The ceasefire had been signed. And Major, at the time, General Barry McCaffrey said, kill them. Kill them all. Now, in his interview with for Vanity Fair, with who was the author? You know who I'm talking about. Oh God, another senior moment. Jesus, I hate this. I hate this. Who? Yeah, Gore Vidal. Thanks, Kathy. In his interview with Timothy McVeigh, Gore Vidal tried to pry inside the mind of Timothy McVeigh, because until September 11, 2001, this in modern times, this was the worst act of domestic terrorism. I know. Slavery and genocide. But I'm talking about, something our little minds can handle. The most severe form of domestic terrorism was Timothy McVeigh's action in Oklahoma City. And Gore Vidal was trying to penetrate what was inside Timothy McVeigh's mind in a series of letters back and forth that were published in not just Vanity Fair, but also in a book by Gore Vidal, then called, what was it called, Kathy? Endless War for Endless Peace or something, where these letters were referenced. Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, or something, where the letters were referenced, and you could read what Timothy McVeigh wrote, and for a mass killer, he was extremely had extreme clarity in his writing. Matter of fact, he made his case very clearly that he had realized that his government was so out of control that he had to react. So he decided to kill 168 innocent people. Makes no sense, but the minds of sociopaths never make sense. Kind of like Major General Barry McCaffrey ordering his troops to kill them all.
Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Or will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul.
Don't be left out. Join your friends at the NSA and Homeland Security and listen to Mike Malloy every single night. They never miss a minute.
It's about 10 before the hour. It's just amazing to me how tight these circles are, right? Barry McCaffrey, Timothy McVeigh, Robert Gates, Iran-Contra, Barack Obama. It really... I don't know. It leads me in weaker moments to believe that everything is controlled by a little group of people. The Rosicrucians, no. The Knights of Columbus, no. The Masonic, no. The Trilateral, no. The it's scary. I have to admit, it's... Now the other one, Barack Obama's new national security advisor, General James Jones. what do you know about him? Well, one of the things that you should know about him is that he is a strong advocate for increasing our involvement in Afghanistan. He's a former Marine Corps Commandant, Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. He stood up against Rumsfeld, the way he ran the war in Iraq. He also opposed the surge that his longtime friend John McCain so passionately defended. But you see, General Jones sees the real fight that we should be involved in as living in Afghanistan, not Iraq. Now, that's a position that Barack Obama has stated throughout the campaign. But, I mean, if I don't know how to... I don't know how to say it without sounding like a smartass, but if Alexander the Great... And the might of British imperialism and the Soviet military, if those three different entities were unable over the course of centuries to defeat the tribes people in Afghanistan, what in the hell would make anyone who was rational think we could do it? And to what end? Why are we fighting in Afghanistan? Wasn't the original reason because that's where the madrasas are? That's where people are taught terrorism. That's where they went to school to learn how to fly jet planes to attack the United States. No, that was right here in our country.
Well, then, why are we fighting Afghanistan? Will someone, is that where Al-Qaeda is? No. Al-Qaeda is in Pakistan. No. It's in Iraq. No. It's in Venezuela. No. It's apparently in Bombay. No. Or Mumbai. No. It's in Kashmir. No. It's somewhere in the outer reaches of China. No. General James Jones says that, quote, "We believe that success in Afghanistan remains a critical national security imperative for the United States and the international community," end quote. He also wrote, "The United States," quote, "the United States and the international community have tried to win the struggle in Afghanistan with too few military forces and insufficient economic aid, and without a clear and consistent comprehensive strategy to fill the power vacuum outside Kabul and to counter the combined challenges of reconstituted Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces in Afghanistan and Pakistan, a runaway opium economy, and the stark poverty faced by most Afghans." But I've declared a moratorium. I am not going to criticize the choices made by President-elect Barack Obama. He certainly knows to a far greater degree, oh my God, light years beyond whatever little dribs and drabs of information I may get doing this talk radio program about the people he is appointing to positions of extreme power. Extreme power, and who are itching to use it. But when you stop and take a look at General James Jones and Robert Gates and, of course, Hillary Clinton, and just write down the list of the names of the people, the careers of the people, the objectives of the people, the philosophies of the people he is appointing to key positions. Do you see what I see? Alexander the Great, the British Empire, and the Soviet Union. All three were roundly and soundly defeated and run out of Afghanistan over the course of centuries, millennia. But General James Jones, newly named Obama's National Security Advisor, believes it's just a matter of sending more U.S. troops there. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Welcome back. 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program on Nova M Radio. We're going to open up the phone lines now if you'd like to comment. We welcome your call. The number here is 800-989-1480. During the break, I wish I had clarity or purity of thought, but I have neither. I could no more think straight than, you could. A couple of emails during the break. Phyllis in Wisconsin says she came in late and hadn't heard the part about General Barry McCaffrey's corporate links, but read the same article I did in the Times. Yeah, we covered that, Phyllis. But Phyllis writes, maybe these people know full well that we'll get our asses kicked in Afghanistan, but they also know that they will become mighty rich while our country is bled dry. So, Phyllis in Wisconsin. So, ever since Smedley Butler wrote War is a Racket back in 1905, 1910, 1903, I don't know. Double Medal of Honor winner, General Smedley Butler. Ever since he wrote about War is a Racket, do any of us really believe that our battles have been for mom and apple pie and the flag and our Judeo-Christian heritage and justice and truth? And come on. If there was a tangential issue of fighting for justice and truth in some of our wars, so be it. But if you think about, and you might even consider World War II, but if you think about all the wars subsequent to that one, and the one immediately preceding that one, they had nothing to do with patriotism, had nothing to do with mom and the flag and apple pie and white picket fences and little puppy dogs, and everything to do with death and destruction for corporate powers or royal families or something. So it is not weird to consider what the New York Times writer had in Sunday's paper and last April about the tons of money being made, not just by these retired generals who act as consultants, but also by the whole war industry. But you know all this. You know this. There's no point really in talking about it. It's just like I say, it's maddening sometimes. And Prairie 2 suggests that he's not too concerned about having the type who are willing to do so-called wet work in the clandestine world, murder. He's not too concerned about that because if you go on the assumption that they do their work out of patriotism and not some Republican agenda, then maybe Barack Obama wants these people to give him advice, to assist in his transition team. But, of course, if that's the case, why did this guy cut and run? The one who said, oops, wait, never mind. So I'm being very, even more confused than I usually am. Again, I wish I had clarity of thought or purity of thought or anything remotely resembling either one. But I'm just kind of wandering around stumbling into stuff. General James Jones, Jim Jones. Oh, can't be his. Well, it is. It certainly is. As far as the economy is concerned, we'll try that tomorrow night. All right, if you'd like to talk, the number is 800-989-1480. Devron is calling from Seattle, listening on the Internet. Devron, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Long time no talk.
Welcome back.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Much obliged. What was I going to say? Yeah, I remember Jim. Man, I tell you, I just got back from the medicinal store out here. Got me some good broccoli.
Oh yeah, well, good.
Yeah, Jim Jones. You said that sending in more brigades, but Gates, I don't know how you feel about him, but isn't he quoted saying that no matter how much we send, that, you know, Afghanistan wouldn't be stable? I mean, I love the, you know, he gave the tally. I was only aware of the Russians being unable to do anything there. But, I mean, just given the terrain and the region, how could anybody do anything? The best we could do is go and build some schools and some hospitals and bring in some technology and win these people over. And that's how you defeat, quote-unquote, terrorism.
Well, you know, my attitude about Afghanistan is my attitude about so much of the world. Why do we think our way is better to begin with? I understand that their treatment of women in that part of the world, based on their religious beliefs, is sick. But I'm against all religions. So, you know, why invade Afghanistan? Why not invade a Colorado City?
Does it matter to you, Mike, who the Bible was written by? Because my father's always told me it was written by Jews. I don't have nothing against Jews, and I'm not trying to hate on them. But I'm trying to figure out... isn't it just a handbook? Why does he have so much hatred? Why do you guys have so much hatred for these religions? Isn't it the people and how they use it? I mean, these books, they're just books. You know?
No, they're much more than books. They are rigid. I mean, you can't say they're just books when you have a whole branch of Christianity that believes in the inerrancy of the Bible. In other words, every word in the Bible is from God, every comma, everything. That takes it beyond the realm of book and into a manifesto or live this way or we will kill you. Thanks, Devron. I appreciate you checking in. As far as Afghanistan is concerned, again, sure, there's some hellish practices by our standards that occur there, but I guess by human standards. And Devron's suggestion is one I certainly agree with. If you want to overcome ignorance, okay, there's ways to do it if you've got the patience, if you're willing to spend 40, 50, 60 years and nobody's going to make any money. War is a racket. War makes everybody rich except the people who have to die. But everybody else gets rich except the people who have to die. And the families of the people have to die. They don't get rich. But everybody else gets rich from war. So war is a moneymaker. Peace is a loss leader. Peace? That costs money. But if we're really interested in peace, in improving the lives of Afghans, if that's what we're about, I don't know why. How about improving the lives of millions of people in this country who don't have health insurance and no job and are facing foreclosure? Why don't we improve the well-being of our folks before we go into a region that has been defeating Westerners for 2,000 years and decide to wage war? That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? That makes great sense. Oh, well, Mike, come on, Jesus Christ, these people came and bombed us. No, they didn't. Those were Saudis who came and bombed us. And an Egyptian, and a Moroccan, and an Algerian. But last time I heard, there wasn't a single Afghan or Iraqi among the 19. If we want to extract revenge, let's head for Jeddah, Mecca, Medina. Whoops, can't do that. So, as far as the question about increasing our presence in Afghanistan, it will prolong the death and destruction, increase the numbers of dead and brain smashed and legless and armless coming back to the United States. It will prolong the misery for the Afghan people. It will do exactly what Alexander the Great and the British leadership and the Russians finally decided wasn't worth the time. And we pull out.
ready for Radical Talk Radio? Make mine Mike Malloy on Nova M.
It is 21 past the hour. Email here from Ron, who apparently is still lost in Pennsylvania. A note on the moratorium. He writes, Mike, I know you said no gnashing of teeth, no kvetching, no left-hand comments about the president-elect, but as the so-called change rant on your mini-blog seems to indicate today, have we been taken for a ride again? If so, what's there to say? What could anyone possibly say, snide or otherwise, that could speak to the level of insult and deflation of hope that would occur if Obama proves to be yet another Republican-light Pentagon puppet? What a body blow that would be. I can feel myself bracing for a kick in the crotch. I'll tell you, Mike, this hawkish BS is a recurrent nightmare. I hope you're right about the Obama purview in these most recent selections for his national security team. We'll see, I guess. Otherwise, oh great mystery, help us. Yeah. We'll see. I'm still going to, although my position is starting to weaken radically, but I'm still going to hold to the idea that there is a method to what appears to be madness out here in our world, which apparently is not the same as the world inside, wherever all these people are inside. You know? All right, back to your phone calls. Marge is calling from Indiana. Marge, welcome to the program.
Well, good evening, my friend.
Hey.
I'm still trying to figure out what they're going to do with Bill. Is he going to become the ambassador of Smooge?
He's probably going to wind up being appointed senator from New York. They won't have to change any of the letterheads. It'll still say
there you go.
Senator Clinton.
Yeah, there's that, of course, whatever. I wonder how long it's going to take him to stick his foot in his mouth. Because he's never been one to be shy about what he has to say or where
No, he hasn't. But apparently he signed like an 89-page contract about what he will and will not do with his wife's ascension to Secretary of State. Didn't you read that thing in the paper where he's going to reveal something like, I don't know.
All the people that contributed to his foundation.
Yeah, huge number, 150,000 names or something. And
holy crap.
He's not going to take any speaking fees unless it's vetted by the Barack Obama administration. He's not, you know, all the stuff that he's agreed to do. You know, this Clinton melodrama is really working on my nerves. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't know where it's going.
Unbelievable.
Did you watch the Q&A today?
No, I saw no television today.
Oh, well, there was one, I don't know who it was. I thought it said the New York Times, but I may be wrong. The reporter asked the question having to do with something that was an exchange between Obama and Hillary during the campaign, you know, trying to elicit some little And and Obama just looked at him, and he said, he answered the question, he says, but, of course, he says, you're wanting to have fun with it. And I thought, damn. He came right back and, you know, challenged the man,
right.
You know, instead of trying to spin it or do a dance
right.
about, you know, well, this is whatever and we're all adults and all whatever kind of crap they choose to come up with. He
right.
says, you're just trying to have fun with it. And I thought, well, imagine that.
Well, let's hope that he continues to do that.
Oh, you know, and then something about, well, that's all you're going to get from me today. He wasn't going to tell him any more than he planned to tell him today. You know, and the things,
right,
the
right.
situations as they evolve, you know, more would be become available, and something about we only have one president at a time. And I thought, yeah, well, anyway. But there's something else I wanted to bring up.
Okay.
It's sort of politics, and it's not. It has to do with broadcasting. I've sort of become a fan of a show called Boston Legal. And if you know anybody that happens to tape the show, get a copy of tonight, because I know it was on opposite you. And anybody on the West Coast that still has a chance to watch it tonight.
Oh, yeah?
There was, I don't know exactly the particulars involved with the fight between a producer, David E. Kelly, and ABC, but something happened. And how the hell he got this script that he's gotten past the network for the last couple of weeks, I don't know.
Hmm.
Tonight, it had to do with an aging person in the person of Betty White, who may or may not be a little bit goofy, you know, because of reaching age, wanted to sue somebody. And she, you know, brings out this big, long, it looked like a computer sheet that, you know, that, a roll that,
yeah.
you know, and goes on. And he was, and John Larroquette was trying to say, well, you can't, you don't have a standing. And then finally she would, you know, she got to the point, she said, the networks. And his eyes kind of lit up. And I thought, uh-oh. She, you know, that the networks don't put anything on that is intelligent. That they're, you know, people over 50 is the largest growing population demographic in the country. They've got more extra money to spend on things.
Right.
But people don't, you know, even consider their wants or needs or whatever. And they just, you know, skew everything to the teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And all this other crap. And some of the lines on the show tonight were absolutely fantastic.
Well, I will do everything that I possibly can, Marge, to track that down and catch the I'm sure they'll have a rebroadcast. We'll be right back.
Don't go to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you on Nova M Radio.
It's about 25 before the hour, but before you go to bed, it's time for Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Once again, gather round, kiddies. Uncle Mike has a scary one for you tonight. Are you ready? It was written by Matthew Alexander, except, well, that's not his real name. I should have felt triumphant when I returned from Iraq in August 2006. Instead, I was worried and exhausted. My team of interrogators had successfully hunted down one of the most notorious mass murderers of our generation, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the mastermind of the campaign of suicide bombings that had helped plunge Iraq into civil war. But instead of celebrating our success, my mind was consumed with the unfinished business of our mission, fixing the deeply flawed, ineffective, and un-American way the U.S. military conducts interrogations in Iraq. I'm still alarmed about that today. I'm not some ivory tower type. I served 14 years in the U.S. Air Force, began my career as a special operations flying pilot, flying helicopter, saw combat in Bosnia and Kosovo, became an Air Force counterintelligence agent, then volunteered to go to work to Iraq to work as a senior interrogator. What I saw in Iraq still rattles me, both because it betrays our traditions and because it just doesn't work. Violence was at its peak during my five-month tour in Iraq. In February 2006, a month before I arrived, Zarqawi's forces blew up the gold-domed Askariya Mosque in Samarra, a shrine revered by Iraq's majority Shiites, and unleashed a wave of sectarian bloodshed. Reprisal killings became a daily occurrence, and suicide bombings were as common as car accidents. It felt as if the whole country was being blown to bits. Amid the chaos, four other Air Force criminal investigators and I joined an elite team of interrogators attempting to locate Zarqawi. What I soon discovered about our methods astonished me. The Army was still conducting interrogations according to the Guantanamo Bay model. Interrogators were nominally using the methods outlined in the U.S. Army Field Manual, the Interrogator's Bible, but they were pushing in every way possible to bend the rules and often break them. I don't have to belabor the point. Dozens of newspaper articles and books have been written about the misconduct that resulted. Those interrogations were based on fear and control. They resulted in torture and abuse. I refused to participate in such practices, and a month later extended that prohibition to the team of interrogators I was assigned to lead. I taught the members of my unit a new methodology, one based on building rapport with suspects, showing cultural understanding, and using good old-fashioned brain power to tease out information. I personally conducted more than 300 interrogations, and I supervised more than 1,000. The methods my team used are not classified. They're listed in the unclassified field manual, but the way we used them was, I like to think, unique. We got to know our enemies, we learned to negotiate with them, and we had adapted criminal investigative techniques to our work, something that the field manual permits under the concept of ruses and trickery. It worked. Our efforts started a chain of successes that ultimately led to Zarqawi. Over the course of this renaissance in interrogation tactics, our attitudes changed. We no longer saw our prisoners as the stereotypical al-Qaeda evildoers we had been repeatedly briefed to expect. We saw them as Sunni Iraqis, often family men protecting themselves from Shiite militias and trying to ensure that their fellow Sunnis would still have some access to wealth and power in the new Iraq. Most surprisingly, they turned out to despise al-Qaeda in Iraq as much as they despised us. But Zarqawi and his thugs were willing to provide them with arms and money. I pointed this out to General George Casey, the former top U.S. commander in Iraq, when he visited my prison in the summer of 2006. He did not respond. Perhaps he should have. It turns out that my team was right to think that many disgruntled Sunnis could be peeled away from Zarqawi. A year later, General David Petraeus helped boost the so-called Anbar Awakening, in which tens of thousands of Sunnis turned against al-Qaeda in Iraq and signed up with U.S. forces, cutting violence in the country dramatically. Our new interrogation methods led to one of the war's biggest breakthroughs. We convinced one of Zarqawi's associates to give up the al-Qaeda in Iraq leader's location. On June 8, 2006, U.S. warplanes dropped 2 500-pound bombs on a house where Zarqawi was meeting with other insurgent leaders. But Zarqawi's death wasn't enough to convince the Joint Special Operations Task Force, for which I worked, to change its attitude toward interrogations. The old methods continued. I came home from Iraq feeling as if my mission was far from accomplished. Soon after my return, the public learned that another part of our government, the CIA, had repeatedly used waterboarding to try to get information out of detainees. I know the counter-argument well, that we need the rough stuff for the truly hard cases, such as battle-hardened core leaders of al-Qaeda, not just run-of-the-mill Iraqi insurgents. But that's not always true. We turned several hard cases, including some foreign fighters, by using our new techniques. A few of them never abandoned the jihadist cause, but still gave up critical information. One actually told me, quote, "I thought you would torture me, and when you didn't, I decided that everything I was told about Americans was wrong. That's why I decided to cooperate," end quote. Torture and abuse are against my moral fabric. The cliche still bears repeating. Such outrages are inconsistent with American principles. And then there's the pragmatic side. Torture and abuse cost American lives. I learned in Iraq that the number one reason foreign fighters flocked there to fight were the abuses carried out at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Our policy of torture was directly and swiftly recruiting fighters for al-Qaeda in Iraq. The large majority of suicide bombings in Iraq are still carried out by these foreigners. They're also involved in most of the attacks on U.S. and coalition forces in Iraq. It's no exaggeration to say that at least half of our losses and casualties in that country have come at the hands of foreigners who joined the fray because of our program of detainee abuse. The number of U.S. soldiers who have died because of our torture policy will never be definitively known, but it is fair to say that it's close to the number of lives lost on September 11, 2001. How anyone can say that torture keeps Americans safe is beyond me, unless you don't count American soldiers as Americans. After my return from Iraq, I began to write about my experiences because I felt obliged, as a military officer, not only to point out the broken wheel, but try to fix it. When I submitted the manuscript of my book about my Iraq experiences to the Defense Department for a standard review to ensure that it did not contain classified information, I got a nasty shock. Pentagon officials delayed the review past the first printing date and then redacted an extraordinary amount of unclassified material, including passages copied verbatim from the Army's unclassified field manual on interrogations and material vibrantly displayed on the Army's own website. I sued, first to get the review completed and later to appeal the redactions. Apparently, some members of the military command are not only unconvinced by the arguments against torture, they don't even want the public to hear them. My experiences have landed me in the middle of another war. one even more important than the Iraq conflict. The war after the war is a fight about who we are as Americans. Murderers like Zarqawi can kill us, but they can't force us to change who we are. We can only do that to ourselves. One day, when my grandkids sit on my knee and ask me about the war, I'll say to them, "Which one?" Americans, including officers like myself, must fight to protect our values, not only from Al-Qaeda, but also from those within our own country who would erode them. Other interrogators are also speaking out, including some former members of the military, the FBI and the CIA, who met last summer to condemn torture and have spoken before Congress at considerable personal risk. We're told that our only options are to persist in carrying out torture or to face another terrorist attack. But there truly is a better way to carry out interrogations and a way to get out of this false choice between torture and terror. I'm actually quite optimistic these days, in no small measure because President-elect Barack Obama has promised to outlaw the practice of torture throughout our government. But until we renounce the sorts of abuses that have stained our national honor, Al-Qaeda will be winning. Zarqawi is dead, but he has still forced us to show the world that we do not adhere to the principles we say we cherish. We're better than that. We're smarter, too. Another edition of Uncle Mike's Story Corner, brought to you by your friends at Torturers Are Us. Matthew Alexander, by the way, is a pseudonym. He led an interrogation team assigned to a special ops task force in Iraq in 2006. And he's the author of How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Use Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. And his piece appeared as an op-ed piece of the Washington Post yesterday. The part that most got my attention was the part that that says the number of U.S. soldiers who have died because of our torture policy will never be definitively known, but it's fair to say that it's close to the number of lives lost on September 11, 2001. If George W. Bush and his gang of murderers is not pursued and brought to justice, then it's probably time for all of us to just kind of be quiet and go about our business. Program's almost over. Time just rips by when you're having fun, doesn't it? It's about 10 before the hour. Thanks to our crew. Program was engineered by Ian Huff, who also answered your calls. Our podcast manager and technical advisor is Ben Birch. Our military affairs correspondent is Sharon Gordy. This program's ethical advisors are Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf. Bruce Enberg is our economic advisor and the executive producer. Is Catherine Bay. I will be here Tuesday night, Wednesday night, and Thursday night, broadcasting from Green 960 in San Francisco. That'll be fun. And Friday night is the gig in San Francisco, sponsored by our affiliate there, Green 960. I hope you have a ticket. I understand they're sold out. And I'm not sure what we're going to do Friday night, but it should be raucous fun. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, I look forward to meeting you. If you happen to get one of the tickets, if you didn't get one, call the station and demand to be let in anyway. Want to do that? Back to your phone calls. Michael is calling from the Bronx, listening on the internet. Michael?
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Okay. First off, I look forward to hopefully you come to visit New York City in the future.
Well, I don't know. We're not carried by a station there, Michael. So it'd be nice if that were to happen. But
I understand.
Oh, good.
But I suppose you were talking about or heard about the Walmart tragedy.
Well, I heard about it, but I can't talk about stuff like that because it just. I don't know. It's just way too bizarre.
It was way too bizarre and something right. That was totally unnecessary.
I feel very bad for the victim.
And so close to the holidays, too.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, the whole story, the guy that got trampled at the Walmart, on one of the Walmarts in Long Island, is what Michael's talking about. I'm sure everybody's familiar with the story at this point.
Now, I think I have a solution to all this.
And you do? What would it be?
Yeah. They need to remodelize their entranceways. Instead of the doors, the kind of doors that they have, why don't they have what I would call terminal doors?
Now, wait. I have a better idea. Why not cut the crap? Why not stop turning the so-called Christmas holidays into nothing but an orgy of materialism and craziness? You know, the retailers who do this should be hanged. The media who promote this frenzy should join them on the hanging tree. This is Michael. This is it's obscenity.
Yeah, I understand.
The whole thing.
I understand what you're
screw remaking the doors.
My thing is about safety. It doesn't just have to be about Black Friday. It could be any particular event.
Right. I understand what you're saying, Michael. I really do. And as a solution that buys completely into the insanity, it's probably a good one. But we don't want to buy into the insanity. You know, I heard something today that they're going to have to move the birth of Jesus into the spring so it doesn't conflict with the Christmas holidays. You want me to repeat that? No, never mind. But the whole thing is madness to me. It's just insanity. I can't, in the first place, I can't imagine standing in the darkness at 4, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning in order to go buy something. Well, I mean, come on. You know, I don't care if they're selling SUVs for $50. My ass is not going to be there. It's crazy. And then the fact that, you know, Walmart does this. What is opening up at 5 a.m.? What? Walmart is the only retailer that ever shows a profit, right? What's the matter? Boys, is your profit falling? You're not going to make $50 billion this year. You're only going to make $48 billion, so let's do this. And let's hire a temp worker. The guy that was trampled had no idea what was about to happen. Walmart didn't brief him. Now listen, when we open the doors, you're going to see a crush of humanity smashing and yelling and ripping and stinking its way into our store in order to grab stuff. So be careful. No, the story I get, they didn't tell him. They didn't brief him. This is crazy. Any Christmas shop? We don't do Christmas shopping, do we? Do we, Kathy? We don't do it anymore. We get some stuff for my grandchildren and our daughter, maybe a gift or two. We buy it from the internet. My adult children, gift card. Here you go. Here's $200. Have fun. I would no more participate in this garbage than I don't know, chop off my left hand. I watch this stuff on Atlanta television on Friday after Thanksgiving. News helicopters flying over the endless supply of malls in Atlanta, Georgia.
reporting, well, this parking lot is 85% capacity. This one's 92. Well, if you're going to go down Interstate 75, you want to go over here to Interstate 85. Blah, 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 blah. Complete gutter sickness, madness. And the right-wing talk show pundits are insisting that this be called the Christmas holidays. You like that? Don't get me started, Michael. Don't get me started. It's too late in the program. As a matter of fact, it's time to pack it in and... Right? I'll see you tomorrow night, Truth Seeker. Take care. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Molloy. This is Nova M Radio.